Davis live in San Jose with their four daughters, Mitzi, Corey, Haley, and Annika, and their two cats, Parker and Dinner. And now I'd like to introduce the respondent, who is John Targin, graduated from BYU after completing a mission in Las Vegas in Chile. An odd combination. He attended graduate school at Northwestern and received a PhD at the University of Utah in organizational behavior and computer systems. He's married to Janet, who is a correspondent and also has been published in Sunstone. John himself is a correspondent for Sunstone and has been published in both Sunstone and Dialogue. He has done many presentations for Sunstone West and for the Salt Lake Symposium, usually pertaining to how the church functions as an organization. He has two daughters, 13 and 9, and he lives now in Bakersfield. So I'd like to go ahead and have the speaker come up and talk, then the respondent, and then if there's any time at all at the end, we'll take a couple minutes for questions. So thank you for coming.
I had these bifocals for about 2 years, and I still have trouble using them. So I hope you'll be merciful to me as I squint and try to work this through. At the May 1994 General Conference, a prominent general authority made the following statement about the breakdown of the family. "This crisis of the family is no surprise to the church. We have certainly known that it was coming. I know of no better testimony that we are led by prophets than our preparation for this present emergency. The scriptures speak of prophets as watchmen on the tower who see the enemy while he is yet far off and who have beheld things that were as yet not visible to the naked eye. For a seer hath the Lord raised up unto his people. 33 years ago, the brethren warned us of the disintegration of the family and told us to prepare. The weekly home evening program was introduced by the first presidency, who said that the home is the basis of a righteous life, and no other instrumentality can take its place nor fulfill its essential function. As a member of the church, admonished to believe what my leaders say, I find these words disturbing, especially the part about how 33 years ago the brethren perceived things that were not yet visible to the naked eye and warned us about the impending breakdown of the family. The problem is that as a scholar of rhetoric, I have come to find that commentary about the impending destruction of the family has been one of the most persistent themes in American discourse for at least 140 years. As a result, I am uncomfortably aware that the brethren were not hearing the still small voice of God, but something much more common and far easier to discern. Instead of predicting the crisis of the family with prophetic insight, they have merely joined the popular chorus. Since the mid-19th century, American discourse has been threaded through and through with complaints about the disruption of the family. If today you heard someone read aloud that easy divorce was destroying America and leaving it, quote, blasted by the mildew of unchaste mothers and dissolute homes, close quotes, you could reasonably assume that he was quoting the words of a contemporary religious or political leader. Few would guess that you were listening to a quote from an article that appeared in the New York Tribune on March 5, 1860. If today you leafed through a 1930 edition of the Journal of Religious Education, you might be surprised to read the following paragraph. Quote, "Nothing in American life is attracting more attention than recent changes in marriage and family relationships. So much is happening that no one familiar with the prevailing conditions can fail to see that the family, long supposed to be the best anchored of all social institutions, has at last broken free from its moorings." Close quotes. It seems clear to me that if ever there were any good old days of strong families and family values, no one appreciated them at the time. The trail of family crisis rhetoric I have tracked through countless old periodicals reveals that not only will Americans complain about the family, no matter what the circumstances, they will do so in virtually the same way every time. Indeed, most such lamentations have the same content. First, a glorious past in which families were intact and values were strong is evoked. Second, the present awful state of affairs is denounced. This is true of the familiar exclamation, "We've got to get back to family values." Americans commonly think of the 50s as this Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet ideal time. However, a 1953 issue of National Parent Teacher Magazine revealed that this La La Land fantasy never existed. Listen to the following bitter complaint. Quote, "All creative forces have their roots in spiritual realities. History fairly shouts that this was the inspiring genesis of America. Yet, in our land of homes and schools and churches, young Americans are growing up in almost utter ignorance of things that alone can stabilize life and give it meaning. Chaplains in the armed forces are aghast at how many youths have but a rudimentary sense of moral and spiritual values. If integrity is the lifeblood of a nation, then America, in spite of her hearths and blackboards and spires, may well be in danger of bleeding to death." Close quotes. A 1922 issue of Child Welfare Magazine suggested that family life had seen its heyday not in the 50s, but at the turn of the century. And I quote, "It is a greater problem to bring up children today than it was 25 or 35 years ago. So say the mothers of today. Children are more assertive today and pay less regard to the advice of their parents. Dancing parties lasting far into the night are making early grown-ups of little girls, and too often the boys and girls are recklessly smoking and drinking until they lose all innocence. There is a spirit of lawlessness abroad." Close quotes. What is clear from these quotes is that we are vague about when the halcyon days of the family occurred, but we believe in them with an unrelenting passion. The persistence and similarity of family breakdown rhetoric is so marked that in 1977, social critic Christopher Lash wrote a book about it entitled Haven in a Harsh World, The Family Besieged. In it, he bemoaned the fact that for over a century, the plight of the family had been discussed year after year as if it were a brand new discovery. 18 years later, in 1994, or five, it is 1995, isn't it? Okay, I better start again. I'm discombobulated. His assessment is valid today. If at the turn of the 19th century, American newspapers brimmed with speculation about the crisis of marriage in the family, as Lash pointed out, nothing has changed. A similar litany pervades the contemporary media and the discourse of religious leaders as we approach the turn of the 20th century. It appears to be a genuine case of deja vu all over again. As Lash expressed it, opinions about the plight of the family clamor on all sides for attention, producing vague speculation, vapid pronouncements, and trendy cultural criticism, much of which, ostensibly radical in its condemnation of existing arrangements, is churned out merely to satisfy the demand for cultural novelties. What does Lash's chilling estimation of family discourse mean for Mormonism and other family-centered religions? In this paper, I hope to at least partially answer that question. First, I will show that the family-religion connection is not a part of Christian doctrine, but is instead an ideology with roots buried in 19th century thought. Second, I will demonstrate that although family crisis rhetoric is a respected part of LDS discourse, it is divisive and discouraging to families and non-families alike. Third, I will argue that family breakdown rhetoric is not promoted by either the Old or the New Testament. The Church often reminds its followers that a fundamental God-given connection between religion and the family has existed from the beginning. This connection is described in a number of ways, all of which are vague. Dallin Oaks explained it in his November 1993 conference address by saying that, quote, "Marriage is necessary for the accomplishment of God's plan to provide the approved setting for mortal birth," close quotes. This explanation portrays the church as the moral underpinning of the family. However, in a talk given at the Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago, Elder Russell M. Nelson expressed it sometimes differently. First, he quoted the 13th Article of Faith and then said, "As a result, we cherish happy and wholesome relationships with our families and others wherever we live. We honor the family as the basis of a virtuous moral life." Here, the family is pictured as the moral underpinning of the church. Note, too, how Elder Nelson presumed that family life as the basis of a virtuous moral life is somehow connected to the 13th Article of Faith. However, the 13th article of faith does not mention the family in its list of virtues. The fact is that in spite of our efforts to be famous as the family church, Mormonism is not at all unique in its pro-family philosophy. In many other religious denominations, the family is portrayed as a fundamental facet of religious life. Conservative Protestantism often speaks of the traditional nuclear family as God's plan for marriage and family living. Catholicism claims that its doctrines are a vital source of norms and beliefs claiming family solidarity. A San Francisco Christian radio station announces its call letter saying, "Bible-centered and Christ-centered, this is KEAR Family Radio." Secular society operates from the same perspective. The recent move in Republican politics has been fueled by the rhetoric of family values and comments about the present crisis of the family. The literature of the KKK contains pro-family rhetoric that is chillingly similar to that of the church. So does Channel 2 in Oakland. It is not a religious television station, but nonetheless, it announces itself with the slogan, "Family to Family," with the big two instead of the word two. The church is misinformed if it thinks we are at all unique in endorsing the family. I am not suggesting that families, values, and the quality of family life are not great and wonderful things. I come from a happy and solid family. Nor am I suggesting that religion and family life cannot do good things for one another. I am, however, quite critical of the way we understand the notion of family in a Christian context. There are several questions we pro-family religions need seriously to consider. For example, if the Bible-based family is Bible-based, why is there so little of it in the Bible? Jesus of Nazareth, Christianity's most central figure, lived a solitary lifestyle. Moreover, he neither coined the term family values nor sat around a cozy hearth with an adoring wife and a passel of children. As theologian Rosemary Radford Ruther pointed out, rhetoric about the biblical view of the family lacks any sense of the socioeconomic history of family over the past 3,000 or 4,000 years. It is as though the Bible endorses a view of the late Victorian Anglo-Saxon patriarchal family as the model for family life proposed in the scriptures. It bears mention that Christian doctrine is not a philosophy of great family life, but one of spiritual change and salvation. Our holy books urge us towards spiritual rebirth, salvation, covenants, community, and of an ultimate and even magical resurrection. True, they contain many admonitions to be kind to the members of one's family, but they also urge us to include the stranger at the gates in that circle of affection and charity. Familiar pro-family maxims like "the family that prays together stays together" do not come from Scripture. Strong Hebrew families and married couples figure prominently in the standard works, but many outstanding characters like Paul are featured as solitary figures. Nor were the Bible families consistently centers of virtue. Cain killed Abel. Yeah, I used to wonder, didn't Eve hold family home evening often enough? Hagar and her son were abandoned in the desert by Abraham. Today, Abraham would be denied a temple recommend for a failure to pay child support. Nephi's brothers were a mean and miserable group. The Book of Mormon may be a wise and wonderful book, but at base it is the story of a family that grew bigger, divided into feuding factions, and finally slaughtered itself. In short, our holy books do not support the notion that the family is the basis of a moral life. If the scriptures do not specifically link religion and the family, nor make a specific endorsement of the nuclear traditional family life as a fundamental factor in the plan of salvation, why do we commonly make this connection? If it is not based on Christian doctrine specifically revealed by God, what makes the family-religion connection seem so profoundly true that even the secular world has some sense of its fundamental connection to all that is good, true, virtuous, and of good report? The answer to this question is lodged in the definition of the word ideology. For ideology is a knowledge that is posed as natural and generally applicable, particularly when its social origins are suppressed. This is true of the family-religion connection, for its status as a transcendent notion is never questioned, and its historical roots are virtually forgotten. The religion-family connection did not begin with the first vision. Although Joseph Smith's visionary experiences were prompted by loving concern for the spiritual welfare of his brother Alvin, Joseph did not enter the sacred grove and ask how he could start a great family church. As a result, it is notable that Mormonism has made an interesting rhetorical journey since its inception. Joseph, who meant to found a true church, seems in retrospect to have founded a family church. I believe we can lay part of the ideological blame for this on a 19th century Protestant minister named Horace Bushnell, who was concerned about the Christian education of children. Dissatisfied with the religious climate of his day, Bushnell sought a theory to correct it. His discontent was natural considering the melancholy mood of religious orthodoxy at the time. Original sin and man's depravity were the politically correct preoccupations of the day. If Christian radio had existed back then, the announcer would have said, "You are listening to Bible-centered and Christ-centered KEAR, Original Sin Radio." The only alternative to this dreary vision was religious revivalism, a frenzied conversion experience that, it was noticed, did not seem to result in permanent change. The dissolute would be saved on Friday night and dissolute again on Monday morning. People felt uncertain of God's love and constantly worried about the state of their souls. It was within this uncertain and alternately gloomy and hysterical atmosphere that Horace Bushnell wrote his best-selling book, Christian Nurture. The secret of its appeal was that it outlined a surefire method for producing Christians. Christians, he asserted, should not be converted as adults, but nurtured from birth in the home environment so that they never knew a time when they were not full of faith. He claimed that this method had a divine mandate for, as he explained, Christianity rested on the covenant promises of God, which were made with families, not individuals. This led him to conclude that conversion to Christianity should come about as a result of the parental role model through a kind of God-ordained osmosis that was to take place in good Christian homes all over the world. Bushnell's theory sent the subtle message to churches that their very survival depended upon the existence of pious homes. No longer was the monastery or the church considered the center of Christianity. Through the theory of Christian nurture, this role was now assigned to the family. As a result, Christian churches and society at large saw themselves dependent upon the family as the source of civic and religious virtue. This, in turn, focused a great deal of attention upon families and family life and set them up to be scrutinized for every failing, each failing seeming to signal the decay of society. This new vision of Christianity was sustained by major changes in social structure that occurred in the 19th century. Prior to 1800, Western society ran on a family production economy in which the vast majority of economic enterprises were home and family centered. There wasn't a separation between work and home. With the Industrial Revolution, there evolved a family wage economy in which family members began to work outside the boundaries of the household in which they resided. The home became separated from the increasingly harsh and monotonous factory workplace, and a new kind of family, the middle-class family, was born. This new family unit, which was promoted and subsequently defined by British moral reformers, required a male breadwinner and a stay-at-home mother whose duty it was to be society's moral guardian through the raising of virtuous children who would become the solid citizens and industrial employees of tomorrow. Thus, in people's minds, the home became a haven from the punitive world of the factory, and the power to regulate human behavior was switched from the political, legal, and military realms to the realms of the middle-class family, specifically an angel mother. Her power to regulate human behavior was a perfect match for Bushnell's theory of Christian nurture. The two theories melted into each other wondrously, creating what one 19th century politician called the religion of the home. With the advantage of hindsight, one can see that Bushnell's religion-family connection was not a strict construction of Christian doctrine, but a theory born out of religious uncertainty, industrial and social change. However, when Yale University established the Horace Bushnell Chair of Christian Nurture, its earthly provenance was headed for obscurity. Naturally, professors holding Yale's Horace Bushnell Chair of Christian Nurture did not try to debunk the theory of Christian nurture upon which their employment and lofty title rested. As a consequence, much erudite discussion of the family religion connection was turned out by academia. Today, the middle-class family, comprised of two parents and a stay-at-home mom, is popularly known in many religious circles as the Bible-based family. However, it must be noted that it differs greatly from the families that actually appear in the Bible. Biblical families were sprawling tribal affairs, often polygamous, and or featuring concubines. And I think it merits notice that if my husband took even one concubine, no one in our neighborhood would consider us a Bible-based family. This is not to say that Mormonism did not try to be consistent with the Bible in establishing polygyny. However, contemporary Mormonism has abandoned and in some ways even denounced its early, more genuinely biblical concept of the family for the one embraced by the common wisdom of the day. Having bought into Horace Bushnell's theory along with everyone else, the church advertises itself as the family church and increasingly interprets its doctrines and rituals through the lens of traditional family values. Talks in which working mothers are admonished to stay home and implicated in the creation of social problems are a symptom of the family ideology that has percolated into the Mormon religious brew. Other LDS notions like continuing revelation and the basic Christian concept of spiritual rebirth must compete with the continual outpouring of family breakdown rhetoric that appears in our publications and is spoken in general conference, and that is virtually the same in tone and content that we would hear anyway in common political and secular rhetoric about the family and in the discourse of many other Christian denominations. Earlier, I pointed out that family breakdown rhetoric has two stages. First, it harkens back to a vague but glorious past in which families were strong and morals were sound. Then, it blames our present social ills on the breakdown of the family, often specifically naming certain accomplices to this destruction, such as the media, degenerating values, gangs, sex, violence, homosexuality, feminism, unwed mothers, working mothers, and neglectful parents. What ought to be concerned to people of faith who embrace it as part of their religious speech is the understanding that this pattern of speech is more than merely recycled rhetoric. It is a force that divides society into opposing factors and which is of little help to families. A speaker who says we've got to get family values does not mean we. His statement is a denunciation of society as a whole, but one which does not include himself as one who shares in the collective guilt. Indeed, he posits an us versus them mindset in which the speaker in his own group is good and the rest of the world is corrupt. Recently, author Roger Rosenblatt surveyed Americans in an attempt to measure public perceptions of the quality of family life. The results revealed the mindset that lies behind a typical family breakdown utterance. As Rosenblatt explained, quote, "There is an enormous discrepancy between how good Americans think they are personally and how bad they think their countrymen are." A national survey measuring quality of family life asked about the modern-day relevance of the Ten Commandments. 75% of those surveyed believe that they personally adhere to the Ten Commandments, but the same majority believe that most others, that would be 25%, could not care less about following them. Rosenblatt suggested that the motto of these people ought to be, "I am the goodness of the 90s. He also indicated that historically this attitude is associated with vanity, self-righteousness, and perpetual suspicion, cynicism, and a nature that refuses to aid those in need. Since the survey attempted to measure the quality of family life, it clearly links family breakdown speech with the assumption that only one's own group has families that are bastions of family values, while others are defined as objects of suspicion. The divisiveness, however, is deeper than that. Religion writer Mike Iaconelli pointed out how family breakdown rhetoric, with its preoccupation with the destruction of society, has created divisions within the Protestant community. Quote, "We have become a nation of fear, afraid to send our children to school, afraid to ride the subway, afraid to leave our houses, afraid of anyone outside our own ethnic group, afraid to send our children to daycare, afraid of AIDS, afraid of homosexuals." Close quotes. He argued that this fear leads to suspicion and cruelty, saying, We are all concerned with the increasing violence, the hate and anger that rules our cities, and the collapse of the family. What worries me is not our common fear. It is what is happening to the conservative fundamentalist wing of the church in the face of that fear. They are sending an army of religious bounty hunters to label and destroy anyone they consider an enemy. The list of enemies gets larger every day. These bounty hunters are really Bible terrorists who see nothing wrong with blowing up someone's reputation or assassinating a person's character. Cacinelli's analysis reveals the complex interrelationship between religion, the family, and civic virtue. In a worldview created by the assumption that the family is the exclusive seat of morality, anyone who does something that is perceived of as against the family becomes guilty of destroying society. In the church, as I've mentioned, working mothers have been the focus of this implication for the last decade. But the division cuts even deeper. The division divides moral believers into two groups as well. There's the moral believer. First, it's the moral believer in everybody else who isn't a moral believer. And then there's a third division which occurs so that moral believers are subdivided into two groups also. Good moral believers who consider themselves the salt of the earth, and bad moral believers whom they blacklist for some spiritual deviance as being soft on homosexuals. With such great potential for division, family breakdown rhetoric is anathema to the very families it seeks to strengthen, because it isolates them in a fearful world of danger, full of potential blame and ever-weakening communal links. If the family religion connection is not doctrinal but ideological, if family breakdown rhetoric is a pointless repetition, it is, at the very least, a way of complaining about corruption. Certainly, people ought to be allowed to vent their fears and frustrations. However, rhetoric about the decline of the family is quite different from the kind of complaining we know from prophetic utterances in the Old Testament. The prophet Amos is a good example of Old Testament despair in this regard. He says, "How terrible it will be for you who have such an easy life in Zion, you great men of Israel, to whom the people go for help. You drink wine by the mouthful, but you do not mourn over the ruin of Israel. Listen to this, you that trample on the needy and try to destroy the poor of the country. The sovereign Lord Almighty has given you a solemn warning. I hate the pride of this people. I hate your luxurious mansions. The Lord says, a day is coming when I will restore the kingdom of David, which is like a house fallen into ruins. I will repair the walls and restore it. The days are coming when grain will grow faster than it can be harvested, and grapes will grow faster than the wine can be made." Note how Amos does not blame the intimate and private sphere of the family for failing to correct the forces that are destroying the world. Instead, he accuses the wealthy and powerful members of society who do not care for the poor and trample on the needy. Note how Amos does not claim a glorious past when families were strong and society was pure. Instead, he points to a glorious future and time of restoration. His message is the opposite of family breakdown rhetoric. The same is true of the message of the New Testament. Family breakdown rhetoric laments the loss of the thing we consider our haven in a harsh world, while the New Testament calls us out of the familiar comfort zones of family, friends, and tradition to embrace strangers and to love those whom we detest. The secular religion of family values has infiltrated real religion and turned whole parts of God's word inside out. It offers litany, ritual, and tradition, but no spiritual peace. Its false prophets sound self-assured and certain, but they teach for doctrine the commandments of men.
First of all, I would like to say that I'm grateful for Sonia's paper because it sheds light, at least for me, on the use of rhetorical analysis. I think that this type of analysis can be a valuable tool for understanding social phenomena. I think it serves particularly well in examining religious discourse. This paper makes an important contribution in this regard. One of the paper's central theses seems to be that the current emphasis on the family in Mormon rhetoric is the same old, same old. That this emphasis is not the product of current inspiration, but rather a rehashing of ideas that have surfaced again and again for at least 140 years in America. I am very sympathetic to the argument that there is nothing new in the world. especially now that I see my 13-year-old wearing broad bell-bottoms, crocheted vests, and paisley. I can't believe 70s fashions are back. Of course, every generation has the same laments as the previous ones. Part of having truly arrived in the parental role is observing how kids these days are just plain wild in their dress, their music, and their morals. I am reminded of the ageless conversation that I get involved with almost weekly at my university. It goes something like this. The standards of students today are abysmal. Student preparation is way down. These kids just aren't motivated anymore. It is ageless in that the same conversation has echoed through university halls since the days of Aristotle. If they had, I don't know if they had halls, but anyway, through the temples. But perhaps we need to be careful dismissing arguments just because they have been around for a long time. In fact, SAT scores are going down, and entrance requirements have slipped dramatically, at least in the CSU system, over the last generation. And this system grants the overwhelming majority of baccalaureate and master's degrees in California, so I think it's perhaps indicative of general trends. The paper stimulated me to reflect on yet another topic which cycles through the church periodically. I call it, quote, last days rhetoric, unquote. Every time a flood or earthquake hits close to home, or is particularly severe, the last days rhetoric seems to ratchet up a notch. I believe that an interesting topic for rhetorical analysis would be to examine last days mentions throughout Mormon history. Some potential times to look at would include the time when comet showers were observed in Missouri, after the Civil War, which was foreseen by Joseph Smith in prophecy. The year, and somebody maybe can refresh my memory, what's the age of man? I was trying to look it up. Is that 70 years old? Anyway, Joseph was promised that if he lived to be the age of man, that he would see the second coming of the Lord. And so it's either 1875 or somewhere around there was many people thought was when the second coming would be imminent or would occur. At the beginning of the last century, beginning the new century, when Harry Truman hailed out of Independence, Missouri, and into the White House. Now, this may seem frivolous, but my mother-in-law assures me that back in Salt Lake City at that time, they thought this was a portentous sign that, somebody from Independence, Missouri was going to come to the forefront of the political scene in the world. And something that personally affected me quite a bit, the food storage scare of the late 1960s. Everybody said, by such and such a date, we all have to have that two-year supply. Of course, I always tell people I have my two-year supply right in my living room. Janet hates this anecdote, but it's my fish tank. I've got 55 gallons of fresh water, protein, and if you scrape the sides, you've got plenty of green. Sorry for that. Another interesting study would be to examine what has happened to the rhetoric in Mormonism and other American Christian churches now that the Soviet Union, otherwise known as the Evil Empire, has dissolved and appears no longer capable of fulfilling its destiny so accurately foretold in Revelations. But back to the paper. I think it makes some convincing points that this emphasis on family is nothing new in American Christianity. This, of course, does not mean that the historical attention to the family has not been the result of continuous inspiration. It is evidence that this is not a unique message for today. A second thesis in the paper is that family rhetoric is absent in the records of ancient Christianity and its forerunner, Judaism, and that therefore there is little ancient scriptural basis for modern Mormon family rhetoric. Based on my reading, I disagree with the argument that the characters in the Old Testament didn't have as strong or even a stronger family orientation than we do today, and that it wasn't central to their religious practice. Just because most of the prophets don't specifically mention family units doesn't mean they didn't feel that the family wasn't central to their lives or faith. The patriarchal order was about family relationships. I believe it was as taken for granted in those days as the changing of the seasons, and was mentioned about as often for that reason. I'm also unconvinced that the New Testament doesn't have a pro-nuclear family message. Jesus evidenced continuing love for his father and love and concern for his mother. Marital references concerning Jesus and others may have been edited out, for all we know. This seems likely given the content of some apocryphal writings. And I apologize for the spelling to Sonia because I didn't run this through spell check. Family references abound in the Pauline writings. The family riffs in Mormon scripture, some of which are cited, appear to me to illustrate the problems with sin and temptation more than the bankruptcy of the family as an institution. I believe that anyone who can't see the primacy of the family in the Book of Mormon is reading it with a severely jaundiced eye. The same holds true of the Doctrine and Covenants. I also disagree with the notion that early Mormonism was not family-centered. In a paper I did for Dialogue, I presented evidence that the members of the church during that period adopted the metaphor of the family to reinforce their communal identity. The emphasis on extended family ceilings and the language of this period both seem to bear evidence that the concept of family and the practice of Mormonism were closely linked during the period. In fact, all viable world religions stress the importance and even primacy of the family. Confucianism, Shintoism, Islam, etc., all reinforce it. The emphasis on family is not just some late Christian artifact. But back to a corollary of the first thesis, that family rhetoric is the same old, same old. The paper seems to argue that this would argue that, that this would well argue that those who preach about the family are therefore not inspired with a message which has particular pertinence for us today. I think one needs to be careful in drawing this conclusion. While the rhetoric about divorce, for instance, has been pretty consistent for the last 140 years, the rates of divorce have taken a dramatic upturn in the last 20 years. Marriage rates have been pretty much constant over the last 120 years, but the ratio of divorces to marriages has gone from 1 to 20 to 1 to 2. And I have, in case we had a projector, I have an overhead here, and this is the rate of marriage. There's a little blip during the baby boomers. Well, here's the Depression, and then here's the people coming back from war. That's the marriage rate. And the latest figures show us right about this level. Divorces show a steady increase and then an exponential growth to this point. So, you know, it's 1 to 2, where here it was 1 to 20. Divorces to marriages. The illegitimacy rates are soaring even faster, and almost every social scientist agrees, and by the way, most politicians nowadays, that illegitimacy is a major contributor to poverty and a whole host of other negative outcomes. And economic factors have had a big impact on the family over the last 100 years. The Industrial Revolution led to mass migration from towns where extended families stayed intact for generations, as they still do in many parts of the world, to cities where families and individuals became increasingly isolated and cut adrift from the support which the family provided. In America today, we have a society whose mobility is unparalleled in the history of the world. It is almost the rule for children, parents, cousins, grandparents, etc., to be spread across state lines, time zones, and even continents. Is it any wonder that more attention needs to be paid to the family in order to keep those bonds intact? While the rhetoric has stayed the same, the world we find ourselves in has not. Which brings me to a corollary of the second thesis, that a family emphasis is not a central theme of Christianity. I am troubled by this conclusion, apart from what I believe to be a lack of scriptural evidence upon which to base it. I feel that even if a family emphasis were not a historical part of Christianity, it should be. I believe in the worth of the family unit. It can mediate and reinforce the core Christian values mentioned in the paper. I believe in holding up ideals. When we don't have ideals and heroes and archetypes to look upon or to look up to, our vision is lowered. Of course, an emphasis on any ideal, such as the family, is a two-edged sword. Ideals result in intolerance of those who fall short, which, according to Christian doctrine, includes all of us, but also tend to elevate society. Nuclear extended families are the backbones of all successful societies and cultures I am familiar with. Individuals can thrive without them, but it looks like societies cannot. I believe most social problems are exacerbated when families don't stay close or intact. Single-parent families in this country are plagued by poverty, crime, abuse, alcoholism, etc., in elevated proportions. I came from such a family. Of course, the root problems may not be the composition of the family, but a strong family structure seems to be the one proven preventative for many of these social ills. Am I arguing that virtue resides only in the Cleaver or Brady or Huxtable households? I don't think so. I agree that problems arise when the rare ideal is the only legitimate model. That is pathological and can lead to mistrust, a lack of caring, and intolerance. I also have problems with the women's stay-at-home message. I think that it not only tends to marginalize women's breadth of contributions to society, but can serve to trivialize the importance of fathering. However, I can't disagree that more parental time in the home with children would benefit society. I just wish we could work toward a society in which maternal and paternal roles are more balanced. I also believe that committed homosexual relationships are not equivalent to nuclear family structures. This is not to say gay partners can't be great parents, or that all or most hetero-headed families are functional. But gay lifestyle issues complicate things. We should not denigrate a valuable institution to make one group feel more legitimated in their differences. This applies to singles, gay or otherwise, orphans, the childless, etc. Just because an individual misses out on something valuable does not mean that a person is less valuable to society or in the eyes of God. Every thinking person should realize that, but neither does it mean that what they are lacking is any less precious. Which brings me to a concern I had in reading the paper. It seemed unfairly negative in tone towards those who engage in family rhetoric. For example, there was a gratuitous mention that the KKK also supports strong family units. The point in mentioning this escapes me. In conclusion, let me state again that I feel this is a valuable paper. I hope it is published and leads to an increased use of rhetorical analysis in the study of Mormonism. I respectfully disagree with Sonia that an emphasis on family detracts from the true message and work of Christianity. Still, I find many of her arguments persuasive. I hope that this paper causes us as a church to re-examine our attitudes about those of us who don't come from or currently reside in the ideal Mormon family, especially because none of us do. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the speakers, and also we have a few minutes now for questions. And if you'd repeat the question so the tape can pick it up, that would be great. Questions? Comments? If not, then we have some time to chat.
Well, maybe Sonia wants to respond to the question.
Sure.
Well, I was pleased with the balanced response that you gave, John, and I was kind of titillated by the thought that I might have been too negative. For some reason, that kind of excites me. I guess because being a woman, I've spent most of my life being sweet, and it's nice to do something different for a change. And I also think that one of my gifts is being too negative, and so it's, I think it was good that you responded and pointed that out. I don't even disagree with a lot of the things that you were saying. As you're saying, just because that we have this emphasis on the family doesn't mean that this. A lot of those things I agree with. One of the things I was concerned about, though, was that the real issue is how we talk about family, and that we talk about it on a shallow level rather than a deeper level. And some of the things that John said were that deeper level that we need to explore rather than to maintain this litany of family breakdown rhetoric, which has a persistent form. And on the other hand, John mentioned a couple of things about illegitimacy and unwed mothers that I thought might reflect some of the typical responses to family breakdown rhetoric that we hear. For example, there are more than one approach to the concern of illegitimate pregnancy in the United States. What you can do is reinterpret illegitimate pregnancy as teenage pregnancy. And what we find is that the rates have stayed the same, but simply that the girls have not been able to marry. And that would be an economic problem, and one that we need to look at. But I certainly am appalled that this is happening, and I feel that what I do feel is that family breakdown rhetoric isn't much help to the public. What it does is it alienates young women. And the other thing is, this is a more deep and complex idea, and it has to do with sex, so get ready. Foucault talked about how the notion of sexual intercourse has been, in our ideas, kind of focused on the middle-class family bedroom, and that has been like a dream to us. Of purity, that if we keep sexual intercourse in that one place, then everything's fine. But when we make sexual intercourse so associated with a dream, we weaken the resistance people have to appropriate times and places for sexual intercourse. And I'm working on some thoughts that indicate that too much emphasis on the dream of middle class value is exciting to our teenagers, that the embrace of intimacy associates with not only the joy that is in and of itself, but also the additional dream of the middle-class family, the white picket fence, the husband who loves you and makes lots of money and stays, you know, and will and stays with you and will support you for the rest of your life while you nurture your children, which is a lovely dream. But it isn't reality. And I don't feel that young girls are helped as they try to resist the perennial advances of young men if they can't think clearly about these issues. So what I would like to see is more clarity and more depth in the way the church talks about family. The other thing I wanted to say is I think, and here I'm not being negative anymore, so this isn't very exciting for me, but it might be exciting for you. I think that Mormon doctrine has wonderful things to say about family. The temple ceremony is takes nuclear families and then it connects them to every other nuclear family that exists in the church. This is such an empowering and wonderful way of joining the notion of man and wife and child, which kind of happens because of egg and sperm and where they're located, and the way that families can become part of the larger community, so that families aren't isolated, worried that they're good families, and feeling the burden of the criticism of family breakdown rhetoric, but are connected to a larger community that will accept them and to which they are sealed. So I would never say that Mormon doctrine doesn't have something splendid to announce to it, the church and to the world about the notion of family. And what I regret is that what we have done is just repeated what everyone else has said and not shared this truly beautiful revelation with the rest of the world and indeed with ourselves.
Well, one of the things I was hoping Sonya might say, but you know, I'll say, is that I think in many people's minds, family value rhetoric, maybe generally in society, but especially within the church or harking back to families, is an expression of yearning for the good old days where the priesthood was in charge, just like, you know, the correlation movement, priesthood in charge of the church. The old days, the priesthood was in charge of the family. And I think it's antithetical to a feminist viewpoint. And I think that's one of the functions that this family values or back to family rhetoric tends to reinforce. It's a subtle subtext there. And that's one of the reasons I think it's a little bit dangerous, because I do think it is antithetical to Christianity as I understand it. I don't, especially Mormon doctrine. Now, Mormon doctrine is practice versus Mormon doctrine is what, you know, I think it was historically, maybe different things, but that's one of another reason why I would criticize the rhetoric. But you're raising your hand. I'm not the chair, but go ahead. Right, why don't you come on up and talk down into the microphone?
It's the microphone
lapel
that
are
going to.
Oh. Oh, yes? Oh. Other people down.
Sonny mentioned that ideology occurs when the secrets of its roots are suppressed, and I think that the danger in Mormonism that we've suppressed our family connections with Mormonism, with polygamy, and we're denying that they were there. I grew up in a family where polygamy was on both sides, but I was one of the youngest children, and nobody talked about it. When I was growing up, and it wasn't till I became older that I started asking questions about it, and I'm transcribing my grandmother's journal right now, and she was the first wife, married when she was 16, and the grandfather took a second wife when she was 19, and the things that the human things that are there, the problems and the yearnings and the loneliness, and there was no outlet for expression of those things for women, and it's these secrets. If we could get into the real roots of comparing, get away from the rhetoric and get into the real meat of who are we and what was the experience of polygamy and how has it affected us instead of denying it. There's such a total richness of who we are that seems to be missing in the family rhetoric.
Isn't that great to have animals that deserve that? Did you have a response? No? I'm sorry, why don't we just pass it just like that?
Thank you. I was going to say that I think the part that I noticed that where all the emphasis on ain't it awful, to use an old games people play term, about the breakdown of the family, because the person who is talking about the breakdown of the family kind of tacitly places himself or herself among the good guys. I mean, obviously I am not part of the problem, but you out there are. And it seems to me that there is an explicit or implicit guilt reaction that is being projected. In other words, if you were a female head of a household and you were married to a monster, it doesn't matter that you ended up divorcing him. You're still part of the problem in the family breakdown. It distorts and oversimplifies the problem of what constitutes a family. And along with that goes the lack of sympathy for those people who find themselves. There is an assumption on a lot of people that if you're out there and you're part of if you're a 15-year-old who has a child, never mind what the circumstances are, and never mind who the father was, you don't talk about him particularly. But you talk about that, and you find that the person who's talking about family solidarity and isn't it awful is kind of, in a way, cutting themselves off from what I think is a basic Christian virtue and ought to be a basic Mormon virtue of reaching out to these people with nurturance and compassion and saying, you're hurting. What can we do to fix this? What can we do to help you fix this? It seems to me that that is one of the major divisive factors in the kind of rhetoric we're indulging in.
About to hand it to her. Is this the best way to do this?
We're going to start weaving our inner. We'll all be joined together as a family here in a minute.
Well, my response is completely in agreement, and I'm glad you elaborated on that point. In a short paper, you really don't have time to get into that. What I think is important is to say that we already have enough things to say from the scriptures. We could just go to Relief Society, hear the gospel preached to us in its simplicity, and we would send people home strengthened whether they were going through one of those awful situations or not, instead of feeling like part of the problem. The gospel is supposed to make embrace you and not make you feel part of the problem. So it seems to me that we don't need to talk about family. We just need to preach the basic Christian message and then go our way and see what happens. And I'm sad that the church has strayed from that.
I think the most dangerous aspect of this family rhetoric, and it also resonated in the speeches today, was that we focus on form over substance, the idea of a biological or even structural family, and saying that that means that that is a family. We know that that isn't true, that even mostly in biological families, we find abuse, we find rejection, we find institutionalized sexism, racism, all those things. And we have to realize that we have to stray away from those statistics that talk about divorce, when we should be realizing that if divorce equals recognition of the individual spirit, then that is the most important thing. Because a family is not defined by the type of people, but instead the substance of the relationship. Especially when there is denigration of a family structure because of their sexuality, etc. We know that that is not what defines a good family. Not their sexuality, not their race, but their substance of relationships. I think that it's very important to stray away from the normal biological, attributions to family, and also realize that possibly And I believe so personally that we are, in general, an over-married society anyway. A lot of people do not need to be in relationships. It's more important to express the individual spirit.
See, this is how Donahue feels.
I was supposed to put this on anyway. We probably lost the whole tape. But anyway, except for the question and answer period, I agree with what you're saying, and that's that you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the problem about family breakdown rhetoric and about the way that we do worry and fret about families. I'm interested in your comment about us being an over-married society, because, and John brought the chart, one of the reasons that divorce has gone up is because the death rate has gone down and marriage has increased also. And so if you have more marriages, you're going to have more failed marriages. There are many other factors that contribute to divorce. I mean, when you're married to a man and it's in 1850, you know that in 5 years, he probably won't live more than 5 years. You're not going to divorce him. You're just going to hope for him to die. And so, also, but if you have to live to 30 or 40 years with someone that you can hardly stand or who's horribly cruel to you, it changes the picture, and you're going to do something to change your life. So these are different ways of looking at divorce more positively. I'm not meaning to put a positive spin on it. I'm just meaning to say most people don't have a common knowledge of what things were like in 19th century, and there were many, many single people in the 19th century. There's some fascinating stuff written about that. During the Irish potato famine, there were hardly any married people because the producing children meant fewer potatoes for everyone. And there were no food stamps. I mean, the punishment for having a child was immediately available. And that was one of the reasons why people restrained themselves sexually, because there weren't a lot of illegitimate pregnancies. So, I mean, again, I'm not saying, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to go back to the Irish potato famine so everybody would be not have very much sex. But what I'm saying is that we have a very simplistic view of how we understand some of the trends of family breakdown in our society today.
It looks like we have time just for one more comment. Oh, you've had your hand up forever, she says. Okay.
For Sonia, I guess, because she's the rhetoric expert. I have heard that you say that family rhetoric has been part of our social discussion for the last 150 years or so, and that it isn't helpful. The family breakdown rhetoric is not helpful. And I agree with John that perhaps the conditions have changed. Even though the rhetoric hasn't, the conditions may have changed. I teach parent education, and I will tell you that parents are terrified. They are literally terrified of the challenges that they have to face with their children right now. So I'm asking you, if family breakdown rhetoric is not helpful, what kind of rhetoric is helpful for families? What would we do instead that would be helpful?
For churches at least, just preach the basic gospel, I think that would be helpful. One of the offshoots of this paper, this is a shortened version of the paper, but I've done a lot of research into the rhetoric that's directed towards parents. And it's part of the reason parents are terrified today. I'm not saying that there aren't some very serious problems, drugs and weapons and AIDS and those things give us some additional sad problems, but we've always had tragedies in our world. We've had starvation. Reading about 19th century factory workers would depress the heck out of anybody. Mm-hmm. We've always had a tragic world where it's come to parenting. What I think might be a good idea for parents is to shut up, is that we just shut up and leave parents alone. I talk to my school principal sometimes. My daughter is 10, and I talk to him occasionally, and he said, you know, they say that parents today are completely neglectful of their children. That's sort of a common thing. That he said, I have all these parents coming in saying, what can I do? And they're ruining their children because they care too much. I think I'm one of them. We've had a problem. We adopted a child with a serious mental illness for 10 years. This child had psychotic episodes, but the thing, and she set fire to people's houses, stole huge amounts of food, left trails of evidence. I mean, it was an awful and serious problem. And, of course, it was, well, why hadn't the Farnsworths taught this child family values? Well, we've been taking her to church every day or every Sunday for years, and it had no effect. We'd done everything that good parents do, involved counseling and psychiatrists, and nothing worked. Well, the additional problem of having to be the pariahs of the neighborhood who somehow had failed this child was made it much more difficult than having to deal with a child with a psychotic disorder. So, you know, I think we should just shut up, teach Christian principles, love each other, and leave parents alone. They really love their kids, and occasionally there's a bad apple, but where isn't there? So, again, I don't see that there's much point in nagging parents to be good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
We'll now go to lunch.